It is that time again, Thursday morning in Las Vegas. I don't care if it's round 8, 9, 10. Don't get your head in a spin. We're going to give you all the latest and greatest insider wisdom, knowledge, and expertise from Tommy Joe Lucian, Kendra Santos. It is the No Spin Rodeo Rally.
Good morning, App 43. Good morning, No Spinners. What you doing out there this morning? If you're in Vegas, you're probably trying to get an IV or wake up and come back to life because you probably stayed out too late last night. We are here at Cowboy Commons, right at the entry of the greatest shopping, Western shopping experience in the world, really. And you can get a mattress and a massage chair and some kind of cream that's supposed to keep hemorrhoids away for like 12 years, if you need that. Good morning. To my right.
Morning.
Greg Teagarden. To my left, screeching in, throwing her stuff down, my co-host, Kendra Santos. Good morning, Kendra.
Good morning.
And I think we, by the end of this run, if they did a poll of coolest guests, we're going to win.
I'm not going to argue with you.
We're going to win, right? Thanks, Garrett.
For once in my life, I'm not arguing with you on that point.
We have with us today, in case you didn't see it, but this guy's been in our business and represents a couple things. Credibility, honesty, cowboy, family, which is the core values of our culture.
It's everything we are, too. Like,
he's one of us. This is the very cool Josh Edwards. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning. Thank you all for having me.
And glad did you here. Have to outdress me? Like, can you buy that shirt at Target?
I'm not sure. I just put on what's laid out.
Oh, do you, you get dressed. You are dressed in the morning. Is that right?
Yeah. I think when you have a physique like a fitness fanatic of this person, it might be custom. He can't buy off the rack.
No, when you're round like me, it's custom. You can find that kind of crap everywhere. But finding, because you know what my dad used to dress me in? Come on, son, we're going to Walmart. The stretchy rustlers.
Oh, Lord.
Stretchy rustlers.
Okay.
That's why I never got. It's just tough. I abuse mentally. Oh, go ahead.
My dad, you know, veterinarian, but time to bank cowboy. He had his whole adult life. He had his shirts custom tailored, not because he was, you know, thought he was big stuff, but because he had broad shoulders, long arms, and a very narrow waist. And I'm guessing that you might have the same issues. Which are great problems.
Do you think, he has broad shoulders? Loomis has broad shoulders.
But Will Loomis...
He's like a pigeon on steroids.
But Will Loomis can probably wear the XL or the double XL and fit because he's stout, you know? He's strong.
He is strong.
I'm not saying Josh... Pound for pound. This reminds me of talking about Ty Murray. Ty Murray used to talk about he wanted to be strong pound for pound. He didn't... He went to the... What was it called? The Nippon Kempo Dojo to do his special exercises.
Because, say that three times fast.
Because he wanted to be strong pound for pound. He didn't want to be bulky or gain weight, but he wanted every muscle to count. And this one, when we get to the Mongol Derby, we'll be talking about fitness, I believe.
Well, that's why Ty got off like a cat, right?
Yes.
I always said his number one asset was his ability to get off. He knew when to get off and how to get off. And, a lot of these guys in the bull riding could have, even in the bareback riding, could probably learn that.
Benefit from that.
So let's talk about Josh Edwards. We spend the top of the show talking with our guest. Interesting man. I'm not going to say years and stuff because I'll always get corrected by the journalist in our family here. Longtime pickup man, NFR pickup man. You've done it all, right? Started with... Rafter G, is that right? Is that where? Is that Neil? Is that who kind of brought you into the fold? Tell us about that.
It is. I started there around 99, I guess. By trade, I was a timed event guy, calf roper and team roper.
Great.
And trips and steers.
Two of them today.
And it just, you know, I would enter the rodeo there. They had the weekly series from April to September, so I roped calves there.
But I heard you were chasing your wife.
Was dating the girl that was the timer. Yeah, guilty of that. So, you know, that was a reason to enter that rodeo every week. And I think just over time it turned into, you know, I got to helping them prepare the calves, and that one thing led to another. And John Patterson was a guy that picked up for them back then, and for whatever reason, someday he couldn't make it, something happened, and Jim said, "Hey, can you step in and help me pick up tonight?" And I thought, "What is that?" You know, I thought the only reason they bucked horses was just to get the time and event guys a chance to swap horses for your next event. So
sure, that's what I think too.
But there are divine appointments. Alan Bach used to call them divine appointments. You know, some people call them coincidence. I call it God's master script. But stuff like that, like that's like Joe Baumgartner here yesterday saying he's at the Tracy, California Junior Rodeo feeding bulls. And the guy's like, "Hey, I need a hand fighting bulls here today." That's a divine appointment for you.
It ended up feeling like that in the end. You know, I mean, once I did it, it kind of hit me like that was the greatest thing I'd done in rodeo. I loved roping calves, and growing up, my dream was always to, you know, make the NFR or a world championship in the calf roping, and immediately that changed. You know, at that moment, I thought, this is a culmination of everything I love about what I grew up doing, you know, riding colts, moving cattle, stock, all the things, and I got to put it together all in one event or one chance in the arena. So I never really quit competing as a calf roper or team roper or whatever.
Were you any good at it?
Depends on I tell you what, I roped calves really well when it was a no-pressure environment. You could go to a 3 or 4-head calf roping or something where you were wearing a baseball cap and a T-shirt, and I roped really well.
But pressure got to you.
Pressure. I never was in an environment, never was taught how to handle that kind of pressure. Like, you know, I roped with some old guys that were around Waco, and I never rodeoed with guys that were necessarily better, and I think you have to do that to be better in this industry. You have to push yourself to be better by competing and being around people that are better than you. I just never was in that environment. So when I'd go to a rodeo, I didn't, you know, it's just like a boxing match. I didn't rope to win. I roped to not lose. And that's not the way you become a champion.
Yeah.
You know, so I never learned how to take those chances, or, you know, I just didn't want to miss. I didn't want to mess up. And that's not how you win.
That's why my son Taylor moved after 2 years at Cal Poly, which is academic supremacy, to Joe Beaver's 8X Ranch in Huntsville, Texas, because it was like, you know, there's a huge difference between, you know, being solid and winning in 2024 for sure.
Definitely. And I didn't come from a rodeo background, so I didn't know that. I mean, I didn't know what I didn't know. You know, I went out and practiced every day, and yeah, I progressively got better, and you know, I went and roped with guys, and ability-wise, I got better, but the mental part of it, I never learned how to.
There's an old saying, like if you don't have all the tools, it's like taking a knife to a gunfight.
Sure.
Right? Yeah.
Sure.
Well, so you retired in 23, is that right?
Can 24? I say something about that?
You can say anything you want.
Because it's so cool. Because it's like, wait a minute. In 2023, here we are a year ago, and were you not the pickup man of the year?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, he's the pickup man of the year at the awards banquet in all of professional rodeo. He's picking up at our Super Bowl, and then the Fort Worth Stock Show is February?
February.
And he retires, and it's like nothing like going out on the top of your game.
There he is.
But I mean, that's like swagger. That's like, you're calling your shot there. But there was a reason, like you wanted to do it there.
I did. You know, there was a reason behind all of it. But Fort Worth to me was a special place. It was what I considered to be my hometown rodeo at the time. I'd moved to Forney, and that's where we live. We're about 50 miles away, but it was the first major rodeo that I ever really got to work. I mean, when I started working for Neil and Jim, I started at Mesquite. The next season, I went to Fort Worth, and I was, 20 years old, and started, untying calves and doing all the things that you had to do when you work for stock contractors, and got to start picking up there. So it was just always a very special place to me. I mean, it was, some years it was miserable, sometimes it was hard, it was cold, and that rodeo was very long. There's so many performances, so many animals to get bucked. But it kind of became a love-hate relationship for a long time, and then eventually it was my favorite place to be. It felt
like
home.
But there was, honor to that rodeo in the Gay family, right, to do it there.
And yes.
Was it, I don't know how many years ago it was, but it's sharpened my mind that's also, that was a special place to you. You retired your great Palomino horse, Hollywood, there. Was he 25?
He was.
But you picked Fort Worth.
I did, and all those things were factors in it. I started with that family. I wanted to end there. I felt like that was, comes full circle for me, that they gave me an opportunity to do something that neither one of us knew that I'd be any good at or would love it as much as I did. And so I felt like that was my kind of ode to them was, I'm not going to do it anymore after this.
It was heartwarming, tear-jerking. Hollywood's out there like this great horse that owes him nothing, and he owes this horse everything, and out there they took his saddle off.
Pretty cool. Now, for our nose spinners out there, because we want to make sure we've got kind of a wide variety, pickup man. In your definition, so the pickup men are the guys that ride and, they do something through the entire performance typically, but the biggest thing they're known for is the rescue team for the rough stock riders, specifically those that ride horses. So they're the cowboys out there. I did find something out yesterday that I didn't know, that I assume you know, that the pickup men here aren't allowed to lead any horses. They got to stay at the fence until the whistle blows. Is that the case?
Yes. You're in our contract, it says you do not move until the whistle blows. They don't want to give anyone an unfair advantage or disadvantage to try to work horses. Now, if you go to any other rodeo in the country, you'll see at least one of the pickup men trying to circle horses or lead horses back, or, they'll know the pattern of those horses, so they'll position themselves in a way that helps them to, be sharper, be faster, or help the horse buck. And we're not allowed to do that here.
That's got to affect some of these horses that are used to being led, right?
It very much does.
You got to kind of hide.
You have to hide from them.
Yeah.
So that's why you see a lot of horses travel here, in my opinion. And also because the arena's small. A lot of horses that would normally circle in a big arena won't here, just because they get lost. Or they'll get in. You'll watch it night after night. You'll see a horse circle, and he'll get right to the fence. And he didn't have enough room to complete his normal pattern, so he'll, turn and go
Stop
down the arena,
and back,
you know,
yeah.
or turn back.
These
or
are conversations I think maybe not everybody would know, that there are conversations at a rodeo. Like, you worked rodeos like Cheyenne, Dodge City, Fort Worth, San Angelo, whatever. The pickup men have conversations with the stock contractor and the cowboys a lot, right?
Oh, yes, ma'am. I mean, every animal.
Ahead of time.
Ahead of time. Especially, and that's where I feel like I was able to really excel in the profession of picking up, was because I worked rodeos that had multiple subcontractors a lot. So I never saw the same horses week after week after week. And so you have to learn how to read the livestock. You have to learn how to work with different animals that are used to being picked up or handled differently. So it made you develop a lot of latitude of how you did that job. There's some guys, and not that they're bad at it, but if you pick up the same set of horses every week, rodeo after rodeo, eventually you can just go stand where they're going to go, and it looks like, man, that guy knows exactly what's happening. Well, yeah, he's seen it 100 times. And so I always felt that gave me an advantage as I was coming up, growing and learning how to pick up, was always working with different contractors. One thing that I did differently you know, you see a lot of pickup men that work for a rodeo company. You know, the rodeo company has their two guys. They go to all their rodeos. And maybe that guy, you know, does an outside rodeo here or there. But for the most part, he works for Calgary, Sammy Andrews, Stay Smith, Pete Carr, you know, name whoever. Well, that I never really did that. Once I started with Jim and Neil at Mesquite, when that started to change, I kind of went out on my own. But I was more of a hired gun. I was never anybody's number one guy. I was always there. I would do two rodeos for Benny Butler, a couple for Servi, a couple for, you know, Pete Carr, Stay Smith. You know, I'd end up with 30 rodeos a year, but I would do it with 8 different contractors. And so I really feel like, in retrospect, I look back and say, that's what gave me the ability to read livestock well, was because I had to everywhere I went. And I never really got to learn all of their horses because I wasn't there long enough.
Reading the situation, that's part of being a real deal cowboy. Are there ever any scrapes between a contestant wanting one thing and a stock contractor wanting something, or a contestant says, hey man, you know, can you try to, you know,
cheat for me,
turn him back a little quicker, something, and then maybe afterwards the stock contractor,
I can't,
like,
ride this horse, could you stand in front of him?
Are there scrapes like that?
There are. I mean, and nobody's doing it necessarily to get a, I wouldn't say an unfair advantage, but, you know, an easy example.
No,
would be,
what's the difference between an unfair advantage and an advantage?
Well, intent.
Politically correct lingo. Right. Go ahead.
Say there's a horse that, you know, in the bronc riding, or especially the bareback riding, where if you catch that horse and bring him back, he's got a real hard turn that really gets guys out of their saddle or loosen their saddle or off of their rigging. You know, and the guy, he might come by and say, hey, you know, he's a lot easier to ride if he goes a little bit farther down the pin rather than if you turn him back right there, or something of that nature.
So who do you work for then? Do you work for the cowboy or the stock contractor?
Well, see, that's the conundrum, because you're being paid by the stock contractor, but the cowboy votes on if you get to do any championship events.
Oh, yeah.
So
see, that, yeah, that's what I wasn't good at, when you got to shake the hands of the people you really don't like.
So it is difficult, you know. I mean, you're being paid by the guy, and so, in essence, you know, you're working for both at the same time. You're trying to take care of this guy and make sure he gets to the next rodeo, gets sit down off that horse safely, and can, you know, that's his profession, and yours is to be a professional as well. At the same time, the stock contractor is hiring you to, you know, we got more cowboys, take care of my horse. There's a $100,000 horse there I need you to take care of. So, you know, it's not a gray area. You just had to do both, and you had to figure out a way to do both.
I would love to hear about your decision to go out on top, the king in your prime. Like, why did you do that?
You know, for me, I have a different mentality than a lot of people, and especially maybe pro athletes or anything like that. I'm a goal-oriented kind of person, and for me, I set goals, you know, when I was a kid, that this is the thing I wanted to do. Now, those changed a little bit, because originally I wanted to rope calves at the NFR. I never imagined growing up that I would ever, didn't even know what a pickup man was, much less be at the NFR, much less be the pickup man of the year. But I'm also not the kind of person that feels like repeating goals is a way to grow. And I know that it sounds counterproductive, I guess, for rodeo, because every year is a different year. And so whether we like it or not, we're judged on how many times we won a world championship, how many times we qualified to the NFR. But for me personally, that was not a factor in why I did what I did. I love to pick up. I still love to pick up. There's a part of me that wishes I was still picking up some days. But the merry-go-round of our industry, it can be hard to overcome. And I've seen, and everybody at this table has seen, you know, guys that have been very successful in this industry and then had to abruptly stop, be it injury or whatever their case was. And it's very hard to compartmentalize that or mentally deal with that loss when you've done something your whole life and it gets taken away from you. So for me, you know, you combine those two things, and I said I always wanted to control how I left. I want to control how I leave everything. And not because I'm a control freak, but because of the fact that I don't want to have any regrets of how I performed or how I left an industry. And so I had always said, you know, when I went to the NFR in 2014, and I always wanted to go back because internally you want to make sure you're not a one-hit wonder, you know. So, and it took me 9 years to get back. Some of it's because of the question you asked a while ago: do I work for the contractors or do I work for the Cowboys? And that's a difficult, you know, blurred line sometimes. But when I did get the opportunity, you know, to go back, I knew that that would be the last time I picked up, because, you know, it's funny. I think I've told you this before. We talked about it. I watched, you know, Peyton Manning retire, and thought, what better way to leave your mark on the industry than to be the best, you know, in a given year and walk away.
Well, Ty Murray and Trevor Brazil to me are my classic examples of here, and they had peace, and it was done. And there are a lot of people who can't take it, and they either really struggle afterwards because that was their whole identity. I mean, what you were saying about to me, I admire that you. I know you have a diverse, you know, business portfolio, and you're a big thinker, you know, a world thinker. Not only, you know, rodeo is a relatively small world in the big world, but the perspective of you knowing. I mean, I watched yesterday. Stetson Wright and Kai Hamilton won world titles here last year. Guess what? I watched them walk through a lot of people, and nobody stopped them for an autograph. Now, I'm not saying they haven't been stopped for autographs, but I'm saying if you're really in touch with the real big world, you're, as Tuff Hedeman used to say, you know, don't believe your own press. Like, don't get too wrapped up in your whole identity as a human being is whether or not you want a gold buckle this year or a, you know, pickup man of the year, right?
Or 10.
Right.
Yeah, and that's exactly.
Because you can be very disappointed when it's over.
You can be. I mean, and I've seen guys, you know, whether it's contestants or contract personnel, chase these buckles for years and years and years and thinking that that's going to fulfill them. And honestly, after the first one, you know, I drove 21 hours home and I realized I didn't really feel any different. And I knew that, okay, I can't let, or I don't want to let, you know, one aspect of my life define who I am as a person, not only for the outside world, but for myself, because I feel like you could get trapped in that and one day you know it's going to be over and then who are you? I don't want to be just Josh Edwards, the pickup man. You know, and it's funny, you know, and I know you're going to go into the Mongol Derby race. So I don't want to skip ahead, but it's worth noting, even out here at the NFR this year, I was, you know, I picked up the NFR last year. I was the pickup man of the year. I've had 100 people stop me and ask me about the Mongol Derby. Nobody even remembers, for the most part, unless you're just a fan, of contract personnel, who picked up the rodeo, who won the award. Those are things that are for you personally, you know, and you never lose those, and they mean so much to you. But in three years from now, nobody will know who picked up the NFR.
Well, and the thing that I've noticed too is nobody does. And like, I've never in my whole life, like, thought about, gee, if I do this or that, I could win an award. Like, never. Like, that's never. I know it's never been your motivation.
No, ma'am.
I the timing of your decision to make a twist also, I believe, has to do with you and Christy having a couple of boys, Blevin and Brennan, who are, it was time to maybe turn a focus inside your family, right?
Most definitely. And I think every person in this industry struggles with that, you know, that balance, because it requires so much time and energy and financial support and mental support to be successful in this industry. And it's really hard to get all that back. You know, that's what everybody's chasing with gold buckles or, you know, I mean, the contestants, obviously they can make a very good living. Contract personnel, you know, if anybody doesn't know, don't make a very good living doing this. So
announcers do.
Some
do
of
they
them
not?
Do. What?
Juergen, weigh in. Yeah, don't announcers
do.
Make a lot of money?
I'm going to plead the fifth on this. I will say this. Announcers make good money, but pickup men should make more than us. That's what I'm going
to
say.
And bullfighters have that. To be put in the same category, right?
Sure, sure. So, you know, with that being said, it's a passion. And I kind of forgot what our – oh, the boys. Sorry. I couldn't forget them. So you have to work on that balance of life. And I think, you know, I know for myself and probably a lot of people out there, I didn't balance that very well in the beginning because I was, like I said earlier, so goal-focused. And I always thought, okay, well, when I reach this goal, everything will be different. Everything will change. I'll have this fulfillment. And it wasn't like that. And so it really made me realize, I tell people this, you know, when I talk about this sometimes, you know, the boys used to, and everybody's kids, when you're leaving for a month or two, you know, your kids are crying and, no, Dad, don't go. And they said, didn't that bother you? And I said, it didn't, because it was compartmentalized that I was focused on what I was doing. And I knew at some point I would be able to go back and explain to them why, you know, and how and instill that same kind of drive in them. What bothered me was when they quit crying. When I would go to leave for a month, and I'd say, "Hey guys, I'm leaving," and they went,
"Peace out, brother.
See ya." And that's when I realized, "Oh shit, we got a problem."
Yeah,
you know, there's too much disconnect there. So, you know, that's when we made a change, and you know, I wouldn't go more than 2 weeks without either being back home or them flying out somewhere so the boys could be there, and we kind of changed how we did that, and. I can tell you a story. I'll try to get through it, and I won't hijack all your time, but it's a pretty significant story that really changed me. In 2013, I had been alternate three or four times at that point. And, you know, it's funny because everybody talks about on social media getting the call. I don't know if you've ever read that. I got the call, you know. So I'm sitting in my trailer, fully shapped. It's 15 minutes before the perf at Henderson, Texas, and I'm holding my phone, you know, just waiting for it to ring with a 719 number, you know, because it's the day that they vote for the final two, you know, and I'm sitting there, and it rings, and I answer it, and alternate again, you know, okay, thank you. So I go in the arena, and 30 minutes later, my horse rolls over on me, breaks my shoulder, my collarbone. And I ended up having to go home and have a bunch of surgery and that kind of thing. And so I'm still at home recovering, you know, on pain medicine and that kind of stuff. And we're flipping through the channels and the rodeo comes on. And I was so sour about it, I just went right through it. And my boys were like, oh, let's watch the rodeo. And I'm like, I'm not watching that. I don't want to see it. And they, you know, they begged. And I was, okay, we'll watch one event. And when it's over, we're changing it. Okay. So I go back, and it's the bareback riding. We watch the bareback riding, and it's over, and I change the channel. And I look up, and my older son, who's 6 at the time, Blevin, he was, you know, kind of teary-eyed and starting to cry a little bit. And I said, hey, man, what's wrong? And he said, oh, I just really wanted you to be at the NFR and picking up. And I thought, well, here's that dad moment where you say, well, man, you know, life isn't always the way you think it is. And you give it 110%, you do your best, and all the dad
the
cliche
standard
stuff.
Answer, yeah.
Yeah. And as a 6-year-old, he looked at me and said, no, it's not that. I just know you won't come home until you get it. And it changed my life.
Yes.
Yeah.
We can all relate to that.
We can all relate.
All three
to
of
that.
Us have two boys, and
yeah, we can all relate to that. I, yeah, So you started out, because we want to get into the race, and then
yeah,
we'll get
ahead.
Into the deal. So you started out saying that you were just kind of middle of the road, calf roper, because you didn't have this mentality of when. I'll call BS on that. Maybe in the calf roping, but in life, with your business prowess, all of the stuff that you did and have done and probably will do, that ain't right. We both know it. You've got to drive to win. And so we're going to talk about this race, and I'm going to let you or Kendra, I mean, get the details. You did this. You retired in Fort Worth, and then you started prepping for the race.
I would love to say a little bit about it, and I would love to put a little PS in there so that people don't come back at me like, oh, I caught you, you blew it. He did officially retire in Fort Worth, but because he had already given his word to the American, after Fort Worth, he did go ahead and fulfill that handshake, correct?
Yes, ma'am.
Right? So to be clear, that's a small detail. The man kept his word. The Mongol Derby, okay, it's an equestrian endurance race, 1,000 kilometers, which is how many miles?
It's about, the 1,000 is about 625.
Okay, and it's, you know, in Mongolia, the world's longest horse race recreates the horse messenger system used by Genghis Khan in 1224, and aboard, you're using wild horses, Mongolian horses, correct?
Yes, ma'am. They're you know, some of them I guess you could classify as semi-wild. I mean, they had ridden some of them or you know, I wouldn't say broke, but saddled at least a bunch of them. But yes, they were not what we would consider broke horses. They gathered them off of the steppe, which is basically like a big prairie, and these herders, it's such a fascinating culture. They still live as nomads, and they just move from place to place, and they graze these herds of, they usually have horses, sheep, and yak. And so they, the way the race is set up is they go out there 3 or 4 months in advance, and they have to locate where these herders are living at the time, and that's what maps the course. So the course changes every year because it's based on where those herders are living at the time. So they find them, you know, say, hey, don't move for 4 months because we got our race coming. They work out all the details with the horses, and then that's what basically sets the race course.
The horses are smaller, aren't they?
They're very small. They're about 12 hands, about 700 pounds, give or take.
And to put that in perspective, the typical calf horse here is probably...
Yeah, there's me.
It looks like you...
The average...
looking at your face on that.
We'll talk about that but, later. But a typical horse here in the timed events is closer, probably 14.3, maybe 11, 1,200 pounds.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, they're probably half that size.
700 pounds.
Yeah, they're about the size of, you know, some of the bigger bulldogged cattle. I mean, weight-wise.
But are they just young horses, or is that their full grown?
No, that's fully grown.
That's fully grown.
And this too was a divine appointment, right? Because I don't know how you ever found out about the Mongol Derby in the first place, but don't you have to like apply or right? And it had been maybe years.
It'd been three years. Since
you
I
just
since
happened to, when were you notified that you were in for 2024?
So I actually was accepted, I guess, in 2023. And the organizers came to Fort Worth to watch me ride. I was the first rodeo guy that, had, you know, they don't really know anything about rodeo. They're distance
Did they bring
races.
Their sheep and stuff in there?
No.
Okay.
No, they did want to come see what, you know, when I talked to them and said, I'm a rodeo pickup man, and they were like, what is that? So they came to Fort Worth, watched the rodeo, and, after the perf was over, I went upstairs, and they said, yeah, you're plenty qualified as far as a horseman. You know, we'd love to have you. But at that time, you could go back to the rodeo stuff, I was contractually obligated to those rodeos that I'd had for years, and I didn't want to not fulfill that. So I asked them if I could push it off to 24. That way I could fulfill all those contracts. And, you know, I'd been at Cheyenne 16 years, Dodge City 15 years, San Angelo 15 years. So I wanted to go back and not just vanish from those people. And you build relationships with committees and the people in the towns. And so I wanted to have closure there for them and me, and fulfill those contracts and then move on. So
I want to hear about your why to do it and how many days it took you. How many days did it take?
It took me 8 days.
8 days
to finish.
To ride how many miles?
Well, I think I rode just under 700. Like the, you know, when they describe it, it's 1,000 miles, but that's the way the crow flies. So when you actually get out there, yeah, everything's in a straight line, but you don't get to go in a straight line because there's cliffs and mountains and rivers and lakes and that you have to navigate around. So ultimately I rode just under 700 miles. I think it was 1,150 something kilometers.
Are there entry fees, and what do you get if you win?
There are entry fees. I think the entry fee just for the race was $17,500.
Wow.
Got to want to do that one.
Yeah.
And what do you get if you win?
Just the
experience.
Wow.
It was a $17,000 and many blisters later so experience.
Let's go back to the why. Why did you want to do this?
You know, I think I'm kind of known for, or, you know, in my own family, I guess, just I have to test myself sometimes. And, you know, some years ago, I had never been a cyclist or a swimmer, or not even an accomplished runner by any means. And, you know, I met a guy that did triathlons, and I said, I want to do an Ironman. And the guy was like, well, you know, why don't you start with, like, maybe a half marathon and see if you can figure that out. But that's really not how I do things either. So, you know, I trained for 9 months and went and did an Ironman triathlon. And actually went to Cancun, Cozumel. I figured if I was going to do it, it might as well be someplace cool. So I went to Cozumel and did an Ironman. And I think every day... And it goes back to what you said, Tommy Joe. I think I didn't have that when I was younger. I didn't have that mental fortitude. And so I think I knew that that was a shortcoming maybe that I just never developed. So I constantly did that to myself. I like to put myself in uncomfortable positions to work through them, and be it physically and mentally.
What do you say to your wife? Well, honey... I'm going to take $17,000 out of the bank account. I'm going to go get on green horses and ride through camels and sheep for 700 miles. What you think?
That's exactly how it goes. And, you know, the first few times I did things like that, you know, she would just be, you know, she was beside herself like, why? What for? What are you talking about? And now she just kind of smiles and is like, okay.
How hard was it? I mean, I don't know what the weather was like. I mean, how did it test you to your limits?
It did. And I think, you know, the limits are different for everyone, but it's definitely brutal. I mean, when you get there, the uncomfortability of the whole thing is what is so unique, you know, and that's what I was looking for, I guess. You know, how do you keep testing yourself in ways that, I mean, there's nothing that I could do, you know, that we haven't done before that makes you grow. I think you have to be tested and be in uncomfortable positions to work through those issues or work through those obstacles to grow mentally and physically. So when I got there, you know, I was there 2 days prior, and then they bus you out to the start camp, which is about a 10-hour bus ride. And then that's it. I mean, you live in a teepee, and they had a start camp set up where they did feed you the first day when we were going over. Like,
I mean, did you ride camels out there?
No, I just rode a bus.
Oh, you rode a bus. So you ride a bus.
Rode a bus.
And you got these herders how did they pick your horses? So the people don't realize you rode from station to station, which was essentially a distance or a time?
A distance. About a distance. 35 to 40 kilometers, just depending on where they were.
Did you draw your horses?
You did. So in the past... that was part of what I thought was the horsemanship, was being able to pick your horse and pick kind of, you know, look through the herd and say, you know, I want that one. But what they came to realize is it's a great sense of pride for those herders that if you're winning the race or at the beginning of the race, the front of the race, to have them ride your horse or have you ride their horse. So they figured out that the herders would start bringing the race leaders their best horses.
Cheaters.
So what the horses, like, what pace did you go
put that
at?
Put that picture up again because I want to find out what's going into
what
this
pace were you, I mean, are you walking?
Fast.
Trotting?
I had a watch that, you know, would time me. So I tried to stay around 27 miles an hour.
You look like you're higher than a kite.
That was, I will say that was, I think, day one or two. I didn't look like that at the end. I was still pretty jazzed about it.
You could be an influencer with those pants. I mean, that's sexy stuff.
What about the saddle? Is that comfortable? I mean,
no, it was not comfortable.
No. What did they feed you? What did you eat? I'm almost afraid to ask.
I didn't eat much.
Was it sheep or?
It was mostly sheep if you wanted to eat it, but I never did.
How much weight did you lose?
I lost almost 12 pounds in 15 days.
Wow.
Yeah. So I basically ate bread and water and a little bit of rice. Now, there was more available if you wanted it, but, you know, they don't have FDA over there, so the preparation wasn't quite
as... You know how sheep herder's bread here is delicious? Was the bread delicious? The
bread was awesome. What wasn't as awesome was, you know, their way of greeting in that culture. They don't shake hands. They offer you a bowl of warm mare's milk. So every time you come into a station, they would. Here's a picture of it right here. This
Is
little
that
boy,
your mare's milk?
That little bowl in the left of it, in his left hand, he came out to greet me, and he brought me the mare's milk. So then after I drank it and he drank it, then I taught him how to shake hands.
Okay, that's
pretty cool.
That's so cool. And this is the kind of stuff that is like, it's mainstream media stuff. And there aren't a lot of things that happen in rodeo in this day and age that make it to the mainstream. It's super cool. And you were very successful.
Yes, ma'am. I ended up winning third in the race. And, you know, at
out of
the beginning,
how many?
44 started. There was 47 people that showed up, but they crippled three before we ever got started, just in the practice and things like that. Because it was pretty treacherous. The ground was treacherous. But 44 people started the race, and only 20 finish. And that's about an average, about
Greg,
50%. Oh, yeah.
Well, I was just going to ask you about when you went to these families, you know, you were accepted. And did you stay with them at night? Did you, you know, sleep in their huts? Or were you camping out?
I did. And that's the one thing that really should be conveyed about the culture of these people. And you try to put it in perspective, like, think about it, you at your house, let's say. Most of them don't know about the race. They don't have internet. There's no phones. So because the race course changes every year and these people are all nomadic, they're in and out of everywhere. So, you know, in the past, would they have seen somebody racing? Maybe, but highly likely that they didn't. I mean, it's millions of acres of just unbridled land. So when I would come up to someone's dwelling, they call it a gur, but it's like a large round teepee. They're just kind of looking at me like, there's this guy with this funny hat on and I'm wearing a big shiny gold buckle. And you couldn't communicate with them. So I had to mime everything, you know, and I would walk up to them and the man would approach me and I would just say, I need to eat and sleep here, and then I would point at my horse and say, he needs water and food, and they'd kind of look at you for a second, and you'd do it again, and eventually...
Did any of them, like, give you the bird or say, get out of here, go to the next girt?
Nope. One family turned us away because they were full. They had, you know, 10 people sleeping in this gur, but they showed us to the goat shed.
Did you ever, because this is like movie stuff, but was there ever a time when you were riding through the desert prairie and all of a sudden you got this premonition? Like, did you see the, you know what I'm saying, where you're supposed to see the mirage?
The mirage.
Did you ever experience, and what did you see?
I never had a mirage, but what's What I did experience is when you ride 90 miles a day under those kind of extreme conditions, you have a lot of time to think. And so it's just you and your thoughts for, you know, 90 miles. Now, in the same time, you're trying to navigate and not get bucked off and it's cold or it's raining or whatever. But in that time, your mind's always running. Or mine is. I don't know. You know, I can't speak for everybody, but that's part of
it. That happens when I weed eat, which is very strenuous,
exactly.
too. I mean, that's not easy to do.
But that was part
Mongolian
of the journey
rider.
For me, you know, was where do I go where I can be totally disconnected from the world for 15 days. I had no contact with, you know, other than the race organizers, nothing that was at home going on in my life. I was totally disconnected from everything, and I got to focus on one singular goal. And it was very awakening, I guess, you know.
A single challenge.
Just one,
like,
single
can
challenge.
Can I do this? Would you have any desire to ever do it again?
No. And it's not because it was too hard or too brutal.
Wiener.
No. It's actually
if I did it
a
once,
little
I'd
more
do it twice.
Philosophical. It's the whole experience was so profound. Going back would just tarnish that because it would not be the first experience again. You would never see it the same way. Your perception wouldn't be the same way. I would know what to expect. And I think not knowing what to expect and being, I wouldn't be uncomfortable the second time because I would know, well, here's what I'm going to do here. Here's, I'm going to stay with this family. I'm going to mime this. I didn't know that when I did it the first time. It's very uncomfortable. Like when you were asking about staying with the people, you still couldn't communicate. So once they took care of the horse, the woman of the house would take you inside. You shared the milk. And then anything they had, they would give you, you know, food-wise.
But did they sit on one side of the girt and just stare at you for 24 hours?
Yes.
That's what I figured. I figured they all just sat in their corner like,
yes. They sat over there, and you know, for 12 hours. They sat over there. I sat over here. You couldn't talk. You just... It was so uncomfortable, but yet so refreshing,
yeah.
You know?
How did it change you?
You know, it changed me a lot. You know, on day six of the race is when I really fell out of the contention for first. I just drew a bad horse. I had to go through some mountains, and the horse just quit. I mean, and just a bad draw. I give Chet Johnson a hard time because everybody knows his 2 years ago on the panel, he said, you know, inferior stock. and I said, you know, I got back and I went to a meeting with Chet and I said, well, inferior stock's not just rodeo, Chet. It's life.
Yeah.
But that's what I really realized is life is, it didn't matter how much you trained for it. There's always things you can't control. And I had to go 5,000 miles away and ride, you know, 700 miles to figure that out.
Are you swallowing those loogies when you do that?
Oh.
Science problems.
So real quick, because and then I'm going to set this up for you, Kendra, because we're going to call this the 5-minute NFR recap. Oh, so you get yourself prepared. You're going to have 5 minutes to do a recap. But I have a question. What the heck could be on your bucket list now? Is there a bucket list thing?
Oh, there is, and that's the beauty of it, is it's undefined. I'll find something. Something will pop up. Somebody will send me something. Maybe it's the Iditarod. Who knows?
Have you ever rode a mammoth?
I haven't rode a mammoth.
I have, by the way. Yeah.
Oh,
I stood on them.
So
have you done
I
that?
Actually take recommendations. You know, if you come across the hardest, most challenging, craziest thing that's out there, send it to me.
I'll work on that.
But when we're talking about diversity and, like, how many different things you have going on in your life, he also chooses to take on the often unthanked and rewarded headaches of giving back to the sport on the board of directors.
Yes, ma'am. You know, and I think it kind of, I've started to see this pattern in myself. You know, it's maybe you're just challenging yourself mentally because the serving people is a challenge. It's always a challenge, and you know, you do your best to make the best impression and lead in the correct way. I think for me, leadership is not I've never sought leadership. I feel like true leaders are put in those positions. They don't seek them. So I never set out to be in the positions that I'm in leadership-wise. I think just with the way I conduct myself and the way I try to help in any situation that I can or serve others, it's put me there. You know, and I never really could explain it, and not to, you know, get religious with you guys, but one day I came across a scripture I was reading or watching TikTok, because I don't have social media, but I do get stuck on that sometimes. And the scripture was, it didn't say what it was. It was Isaiah 6:8. And I thought, well, now I got to go look it up. And it's the scripture where, you know, the Lord is talking to him, and he says, who shall I send? And he says, here am I, send me. And I feel like that kind of culminates who I am service-wise, you know. So it's just like you said, you call it, you know, divine, call it whatever. But I feel like my life has led me into these positions of leadership. And I just want, you know, I don't want to be cliche and say I want to leave it in a better place than I got it. But I do feel like that's where we're at. You know, my kids, my little boy loves rodeo. He's going to be a bronc rider and a great one, I hope. And the people that I know, that their children are all rodeoing, I want them to be in this position sometime and say, man, those guys did it right. You know, they made it better for us. And so, and that's my goal. It's, I don't gain anything out of these positions. There's
You've
no self-serving.
You've earned everyone's respect.
Absolutely.
Period.
Well, I really,
anybody that
means more to me than anything you can imagine.
Well, and your sons see that, like, my sons see that in you. So thank you.
Thank you.
Before we get on to the recap, we talked about Asher at home. We want a chance to make sure everybody knows what your pride and joy is.
If I get a ticket driving back home across the Mojave Desert on Sunday, it will be to get back home to Miss Charlie Hazel Carney. That's
She's
her
beautiful.
Dog, Lou Dog. But what I laughed, I got that yesterday. We had Joe Baumgartner here. And it brought a flashback. This is year 38 for me to work at the NFR. And in 1992, Charlie Girl's daddy, Lane, my firstborn, who was named after the first NFR I worked, was in 1987. And our world champion bull rider was my dear friend, Lane Frost. Well, so I have this baby running around everywhere in a backpack with me. And I would, before the perf, this dear friend of mine, Mary Ann Pemberton, she would hold him and just hold him for me. She was a doll just for two hours and 15 minutes, but I had to pump breast milk.
Sure.
And so at the Thomas and Mack, I pumped the breast milk and I would run it down the tunnel and I would put it in the fridge into the Justin Sports Medicine Room every day. And you know, Joe Baumgartner would be in there and whatever. And on the 10th day, Joe goes, Kendra, why do you bring bull semen into this refrigerator every day? And I said, Joe, it's breast milk for my baby. And he goes, ew, gross. Like he thought, you know, if it was bull semen, it was cool. But anyway.
Well, so we'll hit. Now you have 3 minutes to recap. So let's recap round seven. What do we got? Three rounds left. 8, 9, 10.
It's getting super wild. So, okay, Bradley Miller in the bareback riding won his third round. He was 88.5 on Frontier Rodeo's Full Baggage, who is 22 years old.
Yes.
I'm sure you know
I do.
Her.
I know her well.
Yes. I guess we're really whipping through here.
Well, hold
okay.
on. So on the bareback riding real quick. So we mentioned earlier, Rockersteiner gets knocked out, doesn't go to the sports medicine room. The way concussions work is you get a bad concussion and then you can lightly get tapped and it starts happening. And I'm telling you, it looked like the lights were off.
Last night again.
Right.
Yeah. And that's, you know, that's kind of scary stuff. So, okay, moving forward. Jesse Brown and Dakota Eldridge split the round in the bulldogging last night. They were both 3-5. Dakota's on Swamper, which is there are some horses that are really stepping up. Will Loomis is also riding that horse that belongs to the McGraws in Colorado. Clayton Haas is doing a heck of a job.
Those are rookie horses, right? Isn't Swamper a rookie and Banker, I think? Both.
Yes.
I mean, you're the horse.
And
whisperer.
So, and Swamper, by the way, came from Blake Knowles. Fun fact that I don't know if everybody knows that. But anyway, we got to keep moving here. Coleman Proctor and Logan Medlin won the round. You know, we keep talking this week about people making changes, just anything to change it up. And after, I think it was the fourth round, Logan got off of Coleman's riding his old faithful Bay Headshaker Heisman, who's a character of a horse. And Logan was riding his young superstar horse Cantina and switched and got on old Horse of the Year Drago. And he's like, you know, it just feels like an old pair of boots, like a, you know, hug from a best friend, as my son says.
When Coleman wins, everybody wins.
That's right.
Isn't that
such a great guy?
It just makes you happy. All right.
Okay, we're so short on time.
You got two
here.
Minutes.
So, okay, Brody Kress, 88, wins the bronc riding last night. I don't know anything about Gucci Equine's Foul Motion.
What'd you say?
No. Do I have the... No, Wall Street. 4th Street Rodeos. 4th Street Rodeos is Jeff Davis. Sorry, the lines are really blurred here. Jeff Davis from California owns that horse. Do you know anything about that horse? We don't have time for it. But.
I don't. I know Jeff Davis. I know they have a lot of good stock.
Thank you very much for your input. Go on.
Sorry. Anyway, that horse is about to be 17 years old. I think that's kind of cool. And by the way, that horse came from Rod Hay. 20-time NFR bronc rider who has two boys here. Speaking of two boys, all of us have two boys, including Rod. Hey, okay, where are we at? The calf roping. Dylan Hancock from the roping capital in San Angelo,
Texas.
Fiesta, right? And made the fastest run so far here this week, 6-7. He kind of let his hair down and you know, was Dylan Hancock last night. That was very cool. What can we say? Only two women have taken victory laps here, and Cassie Mary took her fourth one in a row last night. She and Jarvis.
Haley hits two barrels.
I think she's your future
Haley
world champion.
Haley hitting two barrels was insane.
Great.
You know, that was hard. You know, hard. But Haley went from first to seventh in the average, and Cassie's still at fourth. Cassie, remember, hit the first barrel in the first round. Anyway, we're playing beat the clock. Cooper James. Rookie was 88 to win the round.
He doesn't even know why he's riding as good as he's riding.
Right. Pretty cool. When he got to town here this week, he was wearing a high school rodeo buckle. Just saying, now he has two NFR buckles, but that was the E-pen last night.
Right.
How many bulls are going to beat TJ out of the chute? I mean, there's these things that are happening that you're like, you know, how many times are you going to let him beat you out? Right, you know, you got the talent. But we've said this before. It's just as much the mental game as it is the physical game.
Absolutely, and in the eliminators, for anybody who's second guessing, Josh Frost is 67.5 on a little flat spinner, and he kept the score. He's duh. That was a no brainer, and he's done that before, where people criticized him here for not taking any 1A pile.
That's right.
And if he's on course, if he just keeps staying on, he is. Ipso facto, your NFR champ and your world champ.
And your world champ. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, that's cool. Well, that's our NFR recap. Hey, we want to remind all you people, play Pro Fantasy daily. You know, remember, you can jump on there and play it. Just because you do the big rounds with your leagues and stuff, you get a discount. Go in there. You can win some money. You get 100 more thousand to pick. It's really fun. It's not hard. It's engaging. Are you in the Tattoo League? I ask everybody. Pro Fantasy Tattoo League?
I don't think so. No, sir.
Oh, well, why aren't you?
Well, how's it going for you?
Well, I'm sitting sixth. Metters is winning. You're at 10th, so you are coming up. You went from like 26th to 10th.
Okay, I'm 10th, and my dear bull rider hasn't made the whistle yet. I'm hoping for
it. I think I'd be scared of the tattoo. That's why I'm not in the Tattoo League.
She should be, because I've got it picked out. She's not going to like it too much.
It's an ugly piranha fish, and the placement is what scares me. Go ahead.
I told you we'll place it where it won't sag. Okay. Hey, everybody. Thank you for joining us. This has been No Spin Rodeo. Thank you to Greg, Kendra. We appreciate everybody being here today. Come back. We're on Ride Pass, Cowboy Channel Plus app, and on all your podcast platforms. Until tomorrow, be blessed, be safe, love the ones you love. Catch you later.